I'm brave.
Good day to you and welcome. We are the folks from the Alabama Take, and this is our pop culture podcast, Taking It Down. Just a reminder, you can get all your Alabama Take apparel over on our T Public site. It's not hard to find. Visit thealabamatake.com, click on shop, and the T Public site is linked there. You can get hoodies, t-shirts, almost anything. You can give that a look. On today's show, we're talking about the Amazon movie directed by Regina King, her first time as a director, called One Night in Miami. But to begin, we'll cover some odds and ends before we dissect that Amazon film. Let me welcome two exceptional co-hosts. First, Adam Morrow.
Good to be here, as always. Another week, another pod, another cup of coffee.
And Donovan Reinwald. Knitting mittens this week.
Hey, bud.
Knitting mittens.
Yeah, knitting mittens.
Aren't you right next to Vermont up there? Don't you know where these mittens come from?
There's a whole bunch of Patriots fans in between me and Vermont. You don't understand how bad.
Practically a moat.
I gotta go past one Cam Newton if I want to get into Vermont. I'm not doing that. Yeah,
he's not in Massachusetts right now. There is zero chance Cam Newton is spending his winter in Boston.
He would be missing out because you know what? It is lovely and miserable.
The fresh snow, not bad.
Guys,
Blaine,
we have to talk about COVID. How amazed are you both to find out that Trump and his team did not have a plan for the pandemic?
Honestly?
Yeah, okay.
I could have run that story in March.
Yeah. Last March.
Yeah, last March.
2020 March.
2019. As long as you didn't have the specific disease name. Trump has no plan for pandemic.
I did enjoy the side-by-sides of Dr. Fauci, like at the press conference, like the Trump. I think the election of Joe Biden he's going to live 10 more years.
Fauci.
Yeah. I don't know.
Have you seen the thing going around Twitter that someone, a child, asked her dance teacher, who then tweeted this story, that the child asked if she was ready for her Fauci ouchie, which is what she's calling the vaccine. It's pretty good. Fauci ouchie.
I saw Fauci on Face the Nation, and how relieved does this man look?
I mean, he looks 10 years younger. Like, he's not rubbing his head all the time. I had a Fauci ouchie last night, but not the way that kid meant it.
Different thing.
Which will allow us to shift gears.
How hot is Dr. Fauci? He's pretty hot, right?
He does look pretty good for his age.
Right? He runs?
I think he had to give up running because I became fascinated by his running. I think he's a walker now.
Right.
He's accepted that running is not great on a... How old is he?
He's in his upper 70s.
Yeah, that's a long running life.
That's true.
All right, so which brings me to, since it's early in the episode, we're still rattling off. That brings me to one of my...
How hot is Donald Trump?
No, but it does bring to mind this question I asked Adam this week, which is, how do these old guys function? Because it seems like they're constantly doing something. Joe Biden's like 95 and running a country, and to be president and sometimes senator and congressperson, you have to be awake a lot, working.
But what you got to remember is he doesn't do his own vacuuming.
Well, I don't either.
Gardening, he doesn't do that. He doesn't take Ira for a walk.
But he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders and... is up late, and it could be probably, I don't know how many hours of sleep they get. It's just, how do they function at that? Not necessarily like someone Obama's age, but someone like Biden or hell, even Trump, though, or Bernie. Bernie's a good example because he's really old.
Like during his campaign, he would be in Alabama at the Selma March. I remember this day specifically. He was there. Made a speech, I believe, or had an appearance anyway. Then ends his day in Chicago at this huge rally and may have had somewhere else in between. So, like, he's not that those are like California and New York, but that's still a lot of traveling in one day. And it's just another day in the life of a Bernard Sanders. I don't know how you do it. And he's not like on a private jet.
If I travel, that's it. That day's done. And maybe even some of the next day. That's it. Daddy's got to rest.
You get pretty used to it, I will say, the travel component, once you let yourself slide into that frame of mind. But I don't know how they do it continuously. You know, they travel all the time. These Senate sessions will start like when I'm sitting down to dinner half the time, I feel like. They're going after I go to bed. They're crazy.
I guess it's the amount of drugs I have to take to get on an airplane that ruins the whole day.
That's probably it.
Barney probably doesn't.
You can't have quiet anxiety and be a politician.
I guess not.
I don't know. I mean, Bernie probably blazes a dube, gets on the plane, like he's chill.
Speaking of blazing, you know, pretend it's a city from Fran Lebowitz blazing those cigarettes constantly. Before we get into anything new we've watched, Adam, I just wanted to get a final thought from you about you a comment you made that you said Fran Lebowitz has sold you on smoking.
She lines it out pretty well. I mean, her logic is flawless. She's still alive. She is much older than me. She seems fairly content with the things around her, even though she's disgruntled about them. I don't know.
So,
am I wasting all this time extra? Her going on her.
You absolutely are wasting your time exercising. You don't want those years at the end.
Just reminded of the Parks and Rec thing. I think it's Anne. They say something about running, and she says, "Yeah, but at what cost? What cost are you healthier?" The show was fantastic, and her like watching side eyeing the girls pulling the tires for their exercise class Manhattan, and her whole thing about yoga mats. I mean, she's a genius.
There's exercising and there's pulling tires in the middle of Manhattan.
That's not going for a run.
That's CrossFit bullshit.
Yes.
Do you find that level of grouchiness inspiring? Because I my week is mostly just like, oh, Blaine and Adam liked these things. I should probably watch them. So I've been watching a couple of these and they're great. But I just like, I felt so uplifted after watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I felt better about the world.
No, she taps into something.
That crabbiness is great. I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
And she does it in a way that I don't know if she's gotten away with it for years because she's so funny. I mean, I guess that's it, right?
It doesn't hurt, right?
You have to be funny and totally sure of yourself to be grouchy. And there's a difference in grouchy and being an asshole, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, curmudgeonly versus asshole is different.
Like she's not coming to my house and telling me I'm a dick or whatever, right? Like I can.
She's not punching down most of the time.
There you go.
You know, that's the other thing, right? She's like, I have no power. I have no power to change things. Right. Like, she's not making my life worse. She's making it better.
I thought the worst episode of that run, and that's a strong word because I like them all. The weakest one, I should say, was the first one where she's just kind of bitching about New York in
just
general.
Grousing.
So the New York shtick got a little old, but the like just thoughts on different art forms and, you know, it really got cooking. I thought she was not only funny and a curmudgeon, but very insightful.
That first one, I did like, she just spoke directly to me when she's like, it's so much harder to live in New York than it is other places. And I'm like, that's exactly how I feel. Like when I leave New York City, like it's super fun, but then I leave New York City and I'm like, ugh. Like, I know how to live life again.
Yeah, it'd be exhausting.
I was struck, too. And this is a super stupid thing to say. But just like, man, Martin Scorsese knows how to put images together to create a pleasing experience for the viewer. Like, he's good at his job.
I was writing down all of the films that he interspliced that I hadn't seen yet, and I got a little list going, and most of them are available to stream.
Yeah, it was great stuff. He's what a champ. He's awesome.
The hints of how dorky he is, like talking about the different screening rooms, you know, and the different...
He's such a dork.
...actual pieces of film. You know, it's like he wants, like... this version of this movie because it's like a superior artifact. You know, like all that stuff was very interesting. And part of that ties into the New York Times had a piece about their relationship and them watching movies together in these screening rooms. And I don't know, it was cool.
And he was also a champion for leaving the cocaine nugget in Neil Young's nose for the last waltz. So you got to give him credit for fighting for that, though he lost that fight.
Them editing that out in the year that they did is insane.
No, I read about this today again, and like you had had to go frame by frame in a piece of film, and who the poor editors
painted it out basically.
Yeah,
all because he just old Neil got a little careless.
And not to get too tangential, but today is the first day I realized that in The Last Waltz, Neil Young is wearing a T-shirt of two people 69ing.
Yeah, I didn't realize that until last year, and it was shocking. Maybe like around Thanksgiving when everybody watches that for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they watch it, but it's become almost obnoxious on indie Twitter. It's like, well, go watch The Last Waltz.
Well, it was filmed on Thanksgiving.
Right.
But yeah. Donovan, did you are you caught up on WandaVision? Episode 3 dropped this weekend.
I am caught up on WandaVision. How about you, Blaine?
Okay, so we're all caught up on WandaVision. And for anyone listening, we'll just warn right now of spoilers immediately. So fast forward to the next bit if you haven't seen all three episodes that are currently up on Disney+. We got Natalie here with us, by the way. I should have introduced her. So, Natalie, what'd you think about the most recent episode, the 70s sitcom version of WandaVision?
I really loved the Brady Bunch staircase in the background the entire time. I couldn't stop looking at it.
What about the windows, too? The colored windows?
Yes. Yeah, I kept looking for a thematic clue there, but...
Oh, I just thought they looked cool.
Oh, it's good. I like a... I can't remember. Geraldine, is that the character's name?
That's what she's going by in the... box of the TV in the sitcom world.
Dawn.
We didn't talk about this last week. It's Dawn.
Yeah.
It's Dawn from Mad Men.
Dawn and Dawn.
And she's doing a great job.
She's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Any episode where she is, you know, featured, I am all about it. She's been a lot of fun. And this, I got nervous this episode because I was afraid that she was going to like, you know, end up being like a bad guy or something, but it doesn't seem like that's the case. So I'm used with that.
Okay, explain to people who may not understand why it's probably not the case. I think I picked up on most everything and then did some reading. So,
well, I guess I just assumed, you know, once at the end of the episode when they showed the other neighborhood folks like acting strange, like they're in on something, and then she gets sent out of the place, neighborhood, wherever they are. And all the cars surround her or whatever in, I guess, what we assume would be modern day, wherever this is happening. I don't know. I felt like everybody was kind of glitching, I guess. And so her kind of noticing things and bringing things up, you know, once we realized that everybody was kind of glitching, that it didn't seem as like negative that she was. And it was just something was going wrong. Not that she was... like a bad character, I guess, if that makes sense.
I don't think she was glitching. We'll see if I'm borne out in this, but it seems like she's, right, like Wanda may very possibly be holding a town, several dozen people sort of captive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't figure out if that's the case, if this is something that Wanda is doing, or if she is being held hostage and then her kind of just coping.
Right.
So I don't know.
We'll see how it plays out, right? But both times when Vision has come really close to noticing something's wrong, or when the guy comes out of the manhole, and then this time when Vision really, she cuts it. Mm-hmm. So that kind of makes me want, maybe she is just coping, but I do wonder, like, is, that seems like she's got a good degree of agency there. How fun was the sitcom doctor guy, too? Down to the sunscreen on his nose.
Oh, it was so good. It's great.
Both he and the boss are these kind of guys you don't see as much in TV today. These lumpy older men who starred in 50s and 60s sitcoms.
They've clearly had a lot of fun producing a reasonable facsimile of a sitcom, right? And you know, I think that really paid off this week. Something Natalie picked up last week is that it makes the spooky moments even more spooky, right? And so where the neighbor who I had her name a second ago and I've completely blanked on it, but she's Agnes. Trying. Yeah. Right. She's trying to, she gets like desperate. She says, oh, gotta go back to my run. Like it really feels jarring. Right.
Critics are having a field day. Some, I should say, some critics are having a field day saying that this show isn't that good because it's trying to put all its weight behind a mystery to be determined.
It does seem like you're waiting on payoff, right? Like everything that we've seen so far is going to be shaded by something that happens in the future. And I'm not sure that's always the case with shows, but you kind of always know when it is, especially say like three episodes in, you're thinking, is this good? Well, something in the future will determine if this is good or not. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily what's happening now. What's happening now is a lot of fun to watch. You know, like the Brady Bunch staircase and the different homages to different shows are enjoyable, but is it going to kick into next level good? TBD for me.
I wonder how much of that, and maybe this was always going to be the case, I don't know, but I wonder if we would have avoided some of that, like, just what's going on, if, because the releases are out of order, right? Like Winter Soldier and the Falcon, whatever, was supposed to come first. So I wonder if maybe there's some gaps there, like that should have filled in a little bit of here's where Wanda is, at least, you know. I mean, I don't know, but maybe that's something that we're missing.
I don't know if they would have gone ahead and done the release like that. They're pretty careful on what they decide to do and the order they do it in.
Yeah, that's true.
So Geraldine is, this is probably common knowledge at this point, but she's the young black girl in Captain Marvel's 80s. That part of the MCU that happened in the 80s the 90s, where Nick Fury was not the head of S.H.I.E.L.D. So Geraldine is this, what's her name? Monica? And she has a somewhat French last name, Robineau. Wait, no, so you guys didn't know this. Yeah, so, oh, am I dropping spoilers here?
Let's do it.
I don't know, she was talking about it in an interview, right? The actress?
Yes.
About her character, yeah.
Yeah, she's apparently got the role of the young girl, the grown-up version of the young girl from Captain Marvel. And now that she's in WandaVision, it's apparent that she's, Geraldine is just not, it's not her real name. And what Geraldine does is triggers Wanda to get pretty angry and upset about her twin brother who died from the hands of Ultron in a movie. And a lot of people pointed out online this week that that's a pretty big deal because they have not mentioned the Quicksilver character since he died at the end of Ultron.
I read something pretty interesting about how whatever Evan Peters, that guy that plays the Quicksilver version for the X-Men movies, he is rumored to be signed on for WandaVision, whereas the guy who played Quicksilver in Age of Ultron is not. So that could be an interesting, just like, I don't know, it could be cool if that's how it, if that's how it plays out, if it, he shows up as her brother, but then she doesn't recognize him or something, I don't know.
Yeah, it really feels like they're going to try to bring that character back in this show, at least. So we're all thumbs up on it?
So far. The real question is going to be, you know, what, you kind of alluded to this earlier, right? But what is season two like? Is there, how does this show keep going?
I don't know if the MCU has planned multiple seasons of some of these shows.
I hope so. Why. That seems great. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm kind of watching this. I'm reminded of, you know, it was Alan Moore took over Swamp Thing and changed the character. His critique was like, well, it's like The Fugitive. Like, you're drawn by, right, like, this guy's looking for the guy who killed his wife, but you know he can never succeed, because if he does, the show's over. So why, you know, at a, you know, people get tired of watching. So it will be interesting to see if they put a limit on it or do, you know, something different, how they move forward with it. I don't know. It's fun.
My guess is that they treat some of these shows, some of these seasons, as a movie unto itself to leapfrog into the next project, and then that will be the property they'll present to us almost like a movie.
This one seems like it's pretty ideal for a limited series, at least the way they've been doing it. We'll see.
Yeah. Natalie, stick around. I have a question for everybody.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it's okay. It may be a shock to some of our listeners, but we don't all watch the same things. And so, but right before the break, before we take a break, I want to open the floor. You each tell me something you've been watching recently and whether it's a recommendation or if it's a waste of time.
Oh, let's see. We watched some movies this week. The Montmorro Movie Marathon, which is quite the mouthful that you made up. I think the newest one we watched is a Netflix commissioned documentary called Crack. We were flipping through trying to find something to watch and would not have picked that off the list without the trailer. Wasn't really down to watch a drug documentary, but it was such an interesting cultural piece, I guess you would call it.
You guys see enough of that at home, huh?
Right, right. The mean streets of Florence. But no, it was really good. Would recommend. Not necessarily a pick-me-up in any sense of the word, but they interview a lot of folks who are involved and, you know, talk about like the Iran-Contra stuff and the government's complicity in the war on drugs, both sides of it. It was pretty good. Pretty good. Heavy documentary, but a good one. What other movies have we watched? We watched something else. Anyway, you've been watching TV. You've been watching Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Yes, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. Would I recommend it? Probably not. But it's just like if you go into watching that knowing that it's just going to be like campy and goofy and like sickly sweet at times and just real dumb, then it's fun. It's like a fun like Sunday afternoon, nothing to do watch. But I wouldn't say that it's good.
Betty's death really sent Sally in a strange direction.
Yeah, she's the only reason that I watch that show. And then I know I'm late to the game on watching Schitt's Creek, but I've finally been getting into Schitt's Creek, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, my wife has been watching it, and she's really late to the game. I never watched it either, so.
Yeah, it's good.
This week has been... It's been kind of a slow. I've had to get up a little earlier than I'm used to because it's first week back at school. So I've been having to be a little out of my rhythm. You know, I started. It's on Netflix. It's a German series called Dark. I hadn't seen it. But I mean, there's like three seasons. I think it came out 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I'll keep watching it. It seems kind of fun so far.
Yeah, now that one's supposed to be a real mystery box, right?
Yeah. everything else I've watched, we've talked about on the show, except I'd never seen it before. Last Friday, I watched The Big Heat, which is Fritz Lang, 1950-something, maybe 2 or 3. I'd never seen it before. It's pretty, 1953. It's pretty big in noir circles. And it's worth it. Features a youngish Lee Marvin as one of the villains. Glenn Ford's the main character. And about halfway through it, it's about an hour and a half long. So maybe 30 to 35 minutes in, you're like, this is fine, but we'll see what happens. And about half after that, it really kicks off. It's another one of those kind of like with Martin Scorsese. It's like, oh, this Fritz Lang guy. I guess he knows how to make a movie, huh? Who knew? Anyway, my review is good. Things are good. Would recommend.
The movie we were trying to remember here, I'll jump in real quick, was The Man Who Killed Hitler and then the Bigfoot.
With Sam, what's his, you know who I'm trying to, Sam Elliott, right? He's in that.
With Sam Elliott. Sam yeah. Elliott is the man. Pretty good movie. We watched that Friday night.
What was the name of it?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's The Man Who Killed Hitler and then the Bigfoot.
Oh, that's the title.
It is.
and the description.
Right. And it is what it says. But it's got Sam Elliott in it, so.
The pitch is in the title, huh? Yeah. Okay. And you would recommend it or not?
Yeah, I'd recommend. I wouldn't recommend if you're like, I only have 100 minutes to watch something that's going to change my life. Probably not what I'm going to pick. But if you're
about to say if you only have 3 days to live, I wouldn't.
Well, it's kind of the same. Yeah, probably wouldn't put it on the on the list for the way out, so to speak.
Well, let's get into break, and we'll be back on the other side to talk about the Amazon movie One Night in Miami. Okay, as always, your attention is much appreciated. We only advertise for ourselves. We have the website with plenty of writing. You can venture there by going to thealabamatake.com. And while there, you can click on shop, head to our apparel store on TeePublic, or hit up Buy Me a Coffee, where you can make any sort of donation to help the site and the podcast continue. Currently on the site, we've got T.D. Wood giving us weekly coverage on the challenge, which you can read each Thursday just after lunch or Thursday afternoon, usually is when those articles are ready. And if you have a moment, leave us a review or give us a rating on your podcast app for taking it down. Let's get back into our show this week. So we all watched the Regina King movie, One Night in Miami. Listeners can find that streaming on Amazon Prime. The film is based off a play which fictionalizes an actual meeting that took place. It was actually a little bit more than a meeting, as history lays out. They probably hung out quite a bit that evening. So we've got Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, and Sam Cooke in 1964, obviously in Miami. The four of these men are convened to revel in Ali's championship fight that night, and he won the championship against Sonny Liston for the first time that night. And that's your setup. And knowing that this movie is based on a play, I think helps, or makes a lot of sense if after you've watched it, you find that out. I think we will be going as much as you can spoiler from this point forward. So if you haven't seen it and you're interested in watching it, then come back to this segment once you've been on Amazon Prime and watched the movie. Let's open up the floor, though. Donovan and Adam are still here with me. What'd you guys think about One Night in Miami?
This was a good hang.
It really felt like a hang. I mean, that's a common expression, of course. I don't have to explain slang to our listeners, but there were moments of this film that really felt like I was at one of those really small parties or hangouts. In college, when someone would leave the room, the whole dynamic of the conversation or the room changes, or when two people leave the room to go down to the store and then come back. This definitely had that feel, though. The conversations and the weight of the conversations, the outcomes of the conversations were, of course, much heavier and important, I guess is the word.
I thought it was great. I thought what she talked about just there, way that they captured a group dynamic, everybody mm-hmm. was, it helps that we already know who these people are, but everybody was a full character, so much so that, like you said, depending on who was in the room or at the forefront of the room, things changed. Like when it's just Jim Brown and Malcolm X towards the end, or just Cassius Clay and Sam Cooke on their little mm-hmm. venture. I thought that was a testament to how good directing and the writing was. I think Regina King and Kemp Power is the guy who wrote the play that, and then he wrote the screenplay, I believe, too. But
and he also wrote Soul.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah, this has mm-hmm. been a Kemp Power month. Good and interesting that he wrote One Night in Miami is not a new play relative to his work. And Soul, I think he wrote in 2018. So it's, he must be having a good month watching a bunch of stuff. You know, chickens come to roost, so to speak.
Watch those residuals come in.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but his stuff that's been turned into two quality films.
Yeah, they're both very good. I think you have reservations, or I have reservations at times, as much as I enjoy a play turned mm-hmm. film, and I enjoy, just get me in a room, and if the writing's good enough, I'll stay in that room and be compelled the entire time, especially with these four guys at a moment in history where ideas mattered so much. and meant so much. This is perfect. But I really appreciated them fronting each of the characters with a little story, a little vignette.
Mm-hmm. Everything yeah, I think that happened, was needed.
Everything that happened outside the hotel room was spot on. I love the break to go to the liquor store. It was great. Even though there wasn't a lot of quote-unquote action, we often use this as a metric. Did you look at your phone? No.
Adam brought up pretty much what I was going to say. There were some parts during this where it was like, it got a little creaky. Like I wasn't as 100% in it. But overall, to turn a play into like a watchable movie, man, what if, and like, even though like they're mostly in the room, in one room for a big chunk of the movie, kind of like my memory of it is dynamic, right? Like the camera's moving around, they're doing things. And I also walked away from it just being really impressed by the guy who played Malcolm X, Kingsley Ben-Adir. I thought he was fantastic.
I think the last thing I saw him in was Hulu's version of High Fidelity.
Yeah.
He played the love interest.
I was looking at his resume and, you know, it's not really anything I've ever seen. And I thought he was great.
Which is interesting because I felt like Eli Gorey's performance as Muhammad Ali was so watchable.
He was fun, wasn't he?
He was so much fun to watch. And you'd like to think that's what young Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, was like.
I loved the bit, like, because this movie was funny too. Like it was serious, but it was really funny. And I loved the bit in the Sonny Liston fight where, like, he's back, you know, Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali's back in his corner. And he's, you know, you're doing great, Muhammad. He's like, oh, he's ugly. Oh, he's so ugly.
It was good.
Great.
He captured all the mannerisms so well, and everything from in conversation, the way that Louisville accent would come out every now and again.
Absolutely.
To his physical movements in the ring, which is, that's a wide range of things to ask an actor to do, to physically be in shape, to look like one of the greatest boxers ever, and to, you know, everything was obviously a bit slower than it would be at game speed, as you might say, but he still danced around the ring pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. Adam, you opened our conversation with the idea that we all, or viewers would all know going in something about these four men, but I think the movie pointed out to me personally how little I knew about each of these icons.
Interesting. Who was kind of out of focus for you?
Every one of them. Every one of them. Like Malcolm X would mention something and I would think to myself, okay, well, now how was it he died again? I know he was assassinated, but was it just a random person? Was it the FBI? Was it cops? I had to remind myself. And in some instances, I wouldn't have known at all. Like with Sam Cooke. Sam Cooke, I didn't know exactly the order of some of his releases. Well, specifically, A Change Is Going to Come. I wasn't sure when that was released. And as it turns out, the play and the movie fiddles with actual history there. He actually had written and released the song before their meeting in that February. And, you know, name the other two guys, and I still wouldn't have known everything. Jim Brown, I knew he played football, and I knew he went on to become quite an activist, an outspoken guy for his culture and for black people. And then, of course, we have, I also didn't know the Nation of Islam things. When Malcolm X would reference them, I had to look up after the fact who was in charge, who was it he was talking about, how did that come about, which for those who know or don't know, he ends up getting assassinated by the Nation of Islam for trying his own path, if I'm not mistaken, if I've interpreted the history correctly.
Yeah, he became much more of an Orthodox Sunni Muslim. He did go to Mecca. He did make it to Mecca.
Interesting. I have read two short excerpts from his autobiography, but this inspired me to want to read more.
I guess probably the person I knew the least about was honestly Jim Brown. I did. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen him in, I guess at the end where he's quitting football, right? He's filming the Dirty Dozen. That's.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, like I've seen him in things, but I didn't really know too much about him. So I had to do some looking up there. And I was kind of struck with, like, I knew bits and pieces of, I knew some stuff about Sam Cooke because he's a wonderful, wonderful singer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I learned a little bit about Malcolm X in school. And, of course, you know, Muhammad Ali, it's hard not to learn about him because he's great. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I was kind of, you know, a little shame on me. Like, I just didn't, just thinking about, like, I don't know enough to really connect all the dots here.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that'll help me bring up two things that became apparent to me. Often in movies, especially movies that are 20 or 30 or 40 years older than 2020, 2021, you would often have this one black character, and he or she's to be this monolith or this representation of all black culture. And here we get four different possible views of black men in the early 1960s, which leads me to my second thing, which is there was zero discussion, there was zero mention of Martin Luther King at all.
Mm-hmm.
Who's frequently posed as this, as either a monolithic view of black experience in the 60s or as this protagonist to Malcolm X's antagonistic views. And I just thought it was brilliant, and it's probably a part of the play where he's not our center point here.
I did keep expecting a reference because they're arguing over different approaches to the struggle, as Malcolm X calls it.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly Sam Cooke and him are at odds with how to approach that. And I kept expecting the maybe the middle path, you know, of Martin Luther King to be presented or mm-hmm. framed in a certain way. I thought it was just the exploration of what an individual can mean to a larger movement and who's willing to risk what. I thought that was, especially after the year that we've had in 2020, very interesting and very, very well done.
At the center of this movie is Malcolm X versus Sam Cooke, which you talk about that more middle ground kind of take represented by Sam Cooke here. It's an oversimplification of that would be being adamant and outspoken about justice and change versus keeping your disgust of the country inside for the sake of not rocking the boat. That's sort of their stances, the two represent.
Jim Brown points out that Sam is the only one who is not dependent on a white man for a paycheck. I guess, and he quickly says that Malcolm doesn't even have a job.
You don't have a job, which was very funny.
But that quick scene summed up maybe the biggest issue that they're talking around, which is, you know, even him saying you don't have a job, it means that his conception of money and purpose is still tied to a capitalist society, which is rigged against him. And it's Malcolm seems to argue that that's, you can't overcome that. And Sam Cooke is saying, no, if we have the means, if we are, we're vastly oversimplifying this and only talking in context of the movie, not the actual historical folks. But that rub was very interesting mm-hmm. to me because it went so much deeper than just like Sam Cooke setting up long-term success. It's a belief in an institution that maybe other people in the room just saw as so fundamentally flawed that you couldn't, there was no point in taking over.
If they'd considered it at all.
Right. Well, that it's flawed and should just be abolished instead of we need to win in this system. It's like, well, the system is broken. The system has to go.
I think it's a testament to the acting and directing of Regina King, again, the director, that even though the movie does slow a little in the middle, and it did for me, and I think Donovan referenced that, it is still incredibly fascinating and engaging throughout.
Mm-hmm.
It's the good old-fashioned classic internal conflict like you would see in a staged production, but there's this real palpable presence of external danger for each one of these men because of the 1963 context in America. And it does all of this, maintaining engagement, but never becomes like this pedantic kind of finger pointing.
Right. And you know that, you know the outcome. You know that some of them aren't going to make it to the end of the 60s. They talk about Malcolm X's comments on JFK. And if you think of that as like a catalyst for 60s society and what 60s culture became, they're kind of in this moment before all of that coalesces into the full-fledged civil rights movement, into hippie culture, into blah, blah, blah. Like Cassius says something about hanging out with the Beatles.
Yeah.
Early they're on. Funny. And that
they're funny.
They're funny. And there's, you know, there's that famous picture of him punching all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And he's training. That's from days before when this one night is supposed to have happened. And just positioning all of them on the precipice of the tumultuousness to come. I thought that was genius.
I really loved, I guess one of my big takeaways from this is, wow, Regina King should get the chance to make more movies because she's obviously good at it. And wow, I really like Kingsley Benadire. Cause I really loved the way, like, it almost seemed like for me, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but he kind of ended up being my, not point of view character, but I identified with him.
Surrogate.
Most, that's not, thank you. He's the one I wanted to, he's the one I kind of stuck the most with his conflict with leaving the Nation of Islam and being under surveillance with the, and there were just bits where like he's talking with his wife, right? And he sees the FBI agents and he's playing like maybe the room is bugged, but also he's worried about the Nation of Islam guys with him. And I just really, it felt very urgent. His performance of Malcolm X and why he's, you know, on a night where it would be completely great to cut loose and just have fun. Like he's, you know, kind of picking a fight with Sam Cooke and getting so wound up. But I was very sympathetic to him the whole time. I also thought he did a great job, right? Too, of someone just enjoying himself, right? He's taking pictures and
he's so happy for his friend.
I do love when they right at the beginning of the movie, right, Regina King. I really liked all the introductory bits for all of the character, and I liked the bit where Cassius is running his mouth too much, right, in the ring, and he ends up getting clocked in the face, and he's down.
Saved by the bell.
It was great.
Which really happened.
A that win's was a win.
No, you're right about the Malcolm X performance is garners a lot of sympathy for people. Yeah, it does. For people, for a character, a historical figure that normally does not get a lot of sympathy from white America.
He's the villain, right? For a lot of
you can bring up, yeah, you can bring up Malcolm X to people to this day and they will steal distance themselves from that conversation.
I was at a trivia event once where there was a question about Malcolm X and we answered incorrectly. And I was at the bar getting a drink and I groaned. And the guy next to me goes, "Why the hell would anyone want to know that?" And I said, "Well, to win the question."
Well, that and he's a fascinating character who had some excellent points.
Absolutely. You know? But that was the other thing too, is with that the sympathy of the performance really makes you like the sympathy and the urgency of it makes you I can never truly understand what that's like, but in as much as I could understand his point of view, you know, you're in his shoes a little bit sitting there with him. Like I get it. A little bit. I mean, I thought it was great.
He's also the only character that's given a wife and kids. I mean, mm-hmm. not that the other guys had mm-hmm. them at this point, but well, Sam Cooke was married. You meet his wife, but just the like you're saying, the sympathy that's built, the nuance of this guy who is angry at his friends in a lot of ways and angry at the world and angry at America and desperate for change, but he's also calling home and talking to his daughter and has hidden a letter for a favorite book and all, it is much more nuanced, which is the, you know, if you wanted to say, here's these four guys, who do I have to, if you're Regina King, who do I have to make a diverse audience like more than they already do? That obviously he gets the scene with the wife and kids.
But it
went all the way through to, you know, we see Muhammad Ali as a monolith of, you want to talk about monoliths, of this very cocky guy who was an incredible athlete, who was deeply convicted about certain things in society, you know, chose not to go to Vietnam. You know, kind of all the talking points about him. And I don't know if white America decided that he did things the polite way, polite enough to still be a hero and to light the Olympic flame and all those kind of things. And he's shown as being anything but sure of himself in this behind closed doors. And I thought him wrestling with joining the Nation of Islam was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And it didn't, you know, that scene where he's actually joining is kind of jarring. Like that is not a scary room, but it's an intimidating room that he's in. You know, the monochromatic color scheme, the initiation ceremony. It's like, this is serious. This is not somebody who's just kind of taken some tenets from this religion that is not necessarily seen in the best light in America, certainly not then, for the next few decades. He's not just kind of picking and choosing here. He's like, he's going whole hog into this thing. He changed his name. This is a dude who's in.
I really appreciate this movie, and it might be a testament to its strength that it relies on you knowing about the civil rights movement in the 1960s. For the most part, I know we get those vignettes to begin the, but it doesn't do this 1960s montage of the dogs attacking people in Birmingham, or it doesn't, you don't get a before shot of the bombing of the church in Birmingham and what it was like. Instead, it's like, you know these people, and if you don't, go find out about them. Here's what we're going to show you.
It wasn't spoon-fed, you're right.
We were talking about Malcolm X, and how good and serious this movie is, but I can't get it. Like, it was very funny too. Like, there's the bit where he's like, just because I'm militant doesn't mean I don't know how to have fun.
Got ice cream.
Gets the ice cream, vanilla and vanilla. It was great. Like, yeah, it was, that's so hard to balance, right? Because like, when you get serious, it seems like it can kill the fun. And mm-hmm. I did not feel that way watching this movie. It was great.
Well, I'll make a quick note before we wrap that could propel us forward. The time period, at least, kind of goes hand in hand with our viewing of the trial of the Chicago 7. And next month, part of the Warner Brothers releasing movies on HBO Max, they're going to release Judas and the Black Messiah about killing of Fred Hampton, leader of the Black Panther Party, and how he was betrayed by a mole, I suppose, from the FBI, if I'm not mistaken. And that's that stars Lakeith Stanfield and Jesse Plemons and a couple other actors that slip in my mind. I bet we'll talk about that one. It's going to fit some of our themes of late.
I'll watch almost anything with Lakeith Stanfield on it at this point.
Same here.
Same with Jesse Plemons.
Oh, the other actor, the main actor who plays Fred Hampton is the British actor who was in Get Out, who's Daniel, and I.
Oh, yeah.
I cannot remember his last name, and I don't even know if I could pronounce it correctly.
It starts with an O, and I hate to say I can't pronounce it. Oh, right. It's Daniel Kaluuya.
Anyway, that comes out in February, February 12th, Friday. So expect us to cover that in the coming weeks. Speaking of coming weeks, we will be back at you next week.